This is Bird Note. We've all heard about the early bird getting the worm. We know it as sound advice about initiative and timely action, and we can almost see that robin leaning back and tugging that recalcitrant worm out of the ground. Research shows, however, that birds dining early and heavily may lower their life expectancy. A study of three North American woodland bird species found that socially dominant birds stay lean during the day and then stoke up when it's most important, later in the day, before a cold night. At night, birds avoid hypothermia by metabolizing fat. And by staying lean through most of the day, dominant birds are more agile in avoiding predators. Subordinate birds have to look for food whenever and wherever they can find it, and carry fat on their bodies to hedge against unpredictable rations. Dominant birds, which can push subordinates off food, can choose when they eat, and so lessen their odds of being eaten themselves. Therefore, at least in the woodland birds world, the revised moral might read, "Get the worm late in the day. You'll sleep better and live longer." For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note is grateful to all listeners that provide financial support for this show. You can join them at birdnote.org.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Venezuelans in Venezuela overwhelmingly oppose any kind of U.S. military intervention in their country. And most Latin Americans everywhere in Latin America, they know about U.S. intervention and U.S. imperialism, and they do not want to see this.
That's Aviva Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Aviva Chomsky on gunboat diplomacy, then and now. The United States has a long history of intervening in the internal affairs of Latin American and Caribbean countries. From Cuba to Chile, from Grenada to Panama, the U.S. has invaded, occupied, staged coups, carried out assassinations, and imposed sanctions. Today, Washington has oil-rich Venezuela in its gun sights. It has deployed an armada of warships, including the world's biggest aircraft carrier, near Venezuela. It's blowing boats out of the water. It's blowing boats out of the water, which legal experts call extrajudicial killings. It's threatening Caracas with regime change. The White House justifies its saber-rattling rhetoric and aggressive military actions by calling Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro a narco-trafficker. As Noam Chomsky has often said, to best understand U.S. foreign policy, use the mafia model. Very simply, if you obey the master, you're safe. Step out of line, look out. Our guest today is Aviva Chomsky. She's a distinguished historian, author, and activist. She's professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. And now, Aviva Chomsky on gunboat diplomacy, then and now.
I wanted to talk about three different things. One is where what's happening now fits in the longer history of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. The second thing is my analysis of contemporary U.S. foreign policy. What's at stake? What are the different pulls and pushes inside the Trump administration and outside the Trump administration, which obviously is related to the first question, but what are the different sectors that are having a voice here and what do they actually want? And the third thing is migration. and Venezuelan migration to the United States and how U.S. aggression to Venezuela is related to Venezuelan migration to the United States in obvious and in some less obvious ways, and what impact that has on U.S. policy. So those are my three topics. So first, the history of U.S. imperialism and where what we are seeing now fits in this longer history. Most accounts try to begin the history of U.S. imperialism with the Spanish-American War in 1898 and the beginnings of U.S. overseas empire. I trace the history of U.S. imperialism back to 1608. In order to understand U.S. relations with Latin America, U.S. empire, U.S. expansion, we need to see the settler colonial project. We need to understand the history of the United States as a history of settler colonialism and the continuities between early British settlement in the Eastern seaboard with the extremely long history of expansion in the first 100 years of British presence in North America, both before independence, but especially after independence. We tend to learn the history of British expansion as we use the term settlers rather than colonizers, but I insist on using the term colonizers, that is, all of those Puritans and different peoples who came in the early 1600s were colonizers, and that the United States fits very well in the global history of settler colonialism, colonizers who came not to rule over native populations, as, say, the British in India a little bit later on in the 1600s, but rather who came to remove and displace and eliminate the native population and to essentially create a white people's society in a land that's populated by non-white peoples. And we see this happening not only with British settlement or colonization in North America, but also in parts of Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand. We see a very modern iteration of it starting in the late 19th century with the Zionist colonization in Palestine, with the idea that the native population needs to be eliminated to create a country for the colonizers who are coming. And of course, ongoing in Palestine today. The history of U.S. imperialism, if we look at the American Revolution, the war of counter-revolution, we see a real contrast between what happened in the United States and what happened in most other anti-colonial revolutions. And I like to contrast the first two American revolutions, the one in the United States and the one in Haiti, to show these sort of two different models of what an anti-colonial revolution can look like. In the United States, the revolution was carried out not by the people who were colonized, which was the Native Americans and the enslaved Africans. Those were the people who were colonized. Instead, the so-called American Revolution was carried out by the colonizers. It was carried out by the white landowners, slaveholders, land speculators, expansionists. The Haitian Revolution is much more typical of anti-colonial revolutions that we see happening in the 19th century and the 20th century, in that it was carried out by the people who were colonized, in the case of Haiti, primarily the enslaved Africans, and it was carried out to eliminate the entire colonial project, not just to change the specific rulers of the colonial project, but to eliminate the entire colonial project, to abolish slavery, to create a free black country, to dismantle the French-dominated plantation system. And if you look at what happened in the United States after independence, you can see the contrast very clearly as well. That is, independence brought about both territorial expansion, that is, colonization, which starts almost immediately after independence, is the push westward, which is the sort of the second phase of American imperialism, is of the 100 or more than 100 year war, which we call the Indian Wars, but it's really a state of permanent warfare that begins immediately after independence as white colonizers move into Indian territory and massacre, displace, eliminate, remove the native populations in order to expand this white country. And we also see a huge expansion of the slave system after independence. And unlike the Latin American countries, most of which abolished slavery shortly after independence and created a notion of citizenship for all of the peoples of the country, white, black, indigenous, mixed race, and there's a very strong, strongly built into Latin American independence movements, the idea that to create a new country, it has to be a country, as the Cuban independence leader José Martí suggested in the late 1800s, with all and for the good of all, not just a country by, for, and of white people, which was built into the Declaration of Independence, which was built into the Constitution, which was built into the laws of the United States, that this was to be a country of, by, and for white people, and an expansionist country, a country that would grow by taking territory. That is imperialism. So the first century of the construction of U.S. empire, if we want to call it U.S. empire, starting in, you know, with the foundation of the United States, is the continental expansion and what we sort of euphemistically call the Indian Wars. But this set the stage for the United States being an expansionist country in a state of permanent expansionist warfare, which is still going on today. That is, you cannot find a decade in United States history in which it is not engaged in wars beyond its borders, wherever that border may be. You know, from the border of the 13 colonies in 1776 until the current borders of the United States. But wherever the border is, and the border keeps expanding, the United States is engaged in colonial warfare, extraterritorial colonial warfare. But the sphere of that also expands over time. So, of course, in 1848 is the first U.S. war against a Latin American country for the taking of territory from a Latin American country. But the Mexican-American War is really intertwined with the Indian Wars. That is, they can't be separated because it's a war against Mexico, but it's over territory that Mexico also has very tenuous claim to. That is, it's really autonomous native land, even though Mexican has laid claim to it. So the Mexican-American War of 1848 is a war against Mexico, but it's followed by renewed Indian wars because the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo does not establish U.S. hegemony over the territory. It opens the door to renewed conquest of the native peoples of the South and West of the United States. And of course, once the war for the continent has been essentially won, that is, U.S. Domination over the native populations of the continent has been accomplished, the Spanish-American War immediately follows. That's also a euphemistic name because it's really a war against Latin America and the Philippines. It's called the Spanish-American War because the colonial attitudes of the United States do not take into account the native peoples of any of the places they're trying to conquer. And that set of colonial attitudes about whose lives matter is very inherent to empire and to U.S. imperial expansion. But the Spanish-American War is really a war to establish U.S. control over Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippines, which is often left out. So the first extracontinental expansion is the colonization of Cuba, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Now, Cuba is not directly colonized. That is, the United States establishes domination over Cuba without direct colonization. And this is another characteristic that we see of post-19th century U.S. expansion, is that it's often in the form of neo-colonial rather than directly colonial expansion. And what I mean by neo-colonial is finding ways other than direct political control which the United States did establish over Puerto Rico and the Philippines, but working through proxies, working through U.S. corporations, working through all kinds of different mechanisms of establishing domination other than direct colonial rule. And that's what Latin Americans refer to when they talk about neo-colonialism as being quite characteristic of the 20th century. So the Spanish-American War, the colonial takeover of Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and other islands of the Pacific, smaller islands of the Pacific that the United States still exerts direct control, colonial control over, and of course over Puerto Rico, is followed by the era that we learn about as dollar diplomacy, where U.S. expansion expands over the rest of the Caribbean, the parts of the Caribbean that are independent, that is, the parts that are still in the hands of European colonial powers, the French and the British, are relatively free of U.S. warfare during that time. But the parts that are independent, like, say, Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Cuba, are subject to repeated U.S. intervention. Likewise, the countries of Central America are subject to repeated U.S. intervention and long U.S. occupations in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua. So these are also forms of neocolonialism, the long occupations that establish military systems and cultivate new leaders who they leave power in the hands of, and also economic domination. In fact, some historians argue that even before the Spanish-American War, Cuba, for example, was politically a colony of Cuba, but economically a colony of the United States, because the booming sugar industry of the 19th century in Cuba was almost all in the hands of U.S. landowners and corporations like the United Fruit Company. And of course, in the late 19th century, United Fruit is also expanding in Central America, in Colombia, and taking over state-like powers, sovereign-like powers, in alliance with the U.S. government. So finding, cultivating local leaders like Rafael Trujillo or Anastasio in the Dominican Republic, Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua, or taking over territory by U.S. corporations and U.S. investors who the United States is then committed to protecting if their interests are threatened by reformist governments. And this happens frequently and is one cause for the repeated U.S. interventions. The Monroe Doctrine in 1823, about less than 50 years after U.S. independence, states that the United States basically reserves the right to intervene in Latin America anytime they want. The Roosevelt Corollary in 1906 updates this to say, the Monroe Doctrine said we'll intervene if Latin American countries are threatened with European intervention. The Roosevelt Corollary says we will intervene if the interests of U.S. Economic forces in Latin America are threatened by local protests or governments. And it's really interesting reading the words of U.S. policymakers that we know that there are local forces that want to prioritize the interests of the native populations of these countries over the interests of U.S. investors, but we will not let that happen. That is, if the governments do not prioritize the interests of U.S. investors, then we will intervene. And in particular, this conflict between the interests of local populations, native populations, and U.S. investors come to the fore in the case of taxation, in the case of labor rights, in the case of land rights. So anytime a government tries to promote the national interests of their populations over the interests of the foreign investors, the United States will intervene to overthrow them. After World War II, the sphere of interest where the United States feels that it's prerogative to intervene, to do these things, expands beyond the islands of the Pacific, Central America, and the Caribbean. So we see this geographical expansion increasing in Southeast Asia, in Iran, where the United States intervenes to overthrow a democratically elected government, in Guatemala, the same thing. Sometimes this is at the behest of a specific company, as it is in the case of Guatemala, at the behest of the United Fruit Company in 1954, to overthrow a democratically elected government that is precisely privileging the interests of its own population for access to land, for labor rights, for the right to unionize, for minimum wages, which is overthrown, or not necessarily at the behest of a specific company, but for multiple interests, which I'm going to talk about more in the second part of the talk. And elsewhere in Latin America as well, as we see in the case of Chile, for example, in 1973, where the United States again intervenes to overthrow a democratically elected government that is prioritizing the needs of its own population over those of U.S. investors, especially in the mining and so-called public utilities industries. So there are different rationales that the U.S. population is given for these interventions. During the first century and into the mid-20th century, really, their struggles against barbarism, their struggles against uncivilized peoples, their struggles against people who don't know how to govern themselves, who are dangerous. And this coalesces by the mid-19th century under the terminology of banditry. The United States has to intervene in, whether it's in the Western United States, what is now the Western United States, in Mexico, in Central America, in the Caribbean, because of the threat of banditry. That is, people who are threatening U.S. interests. In the post-World War II period, banditry is replaced by communism as being the threat that Latin Americans are subject to, and that the United States has to intervene to so-called protect them and U.S. interests in Latin America from the threat of communism. After 1989, U.S. intervention and the collapse of the socialist bloc, U.S. interventions do not stop. They just start taking on new rationales. We get the drug wars. We have to intervene because these dangerous Latin Americans are producing and exporting drugs. The war on terror, especially after 9/11, becomes the next pretext for constant interventions. So again, we do not see a pause in U.S. colonial interventions in Latin America from 1776 until today, I would say. Okay, part two. What are some of the motivations? What are some of the sectors that have a stake in U.S. foreign policy? There's some that have a stake in U.S. expansion and intervention more generally, and some specifically in Venezuela right now. So, like, why Venezuela? And why right now? I think there's a bunch of different things going on. Some are very particular to Trump. Some are particular to divisions within the Trump coalition or the MAGA coalition. And some are related to specific U.S. economic interests. So let me just mention a few of those. And I was talking about this in one of my classes this week. And one of my students said, well, Maduro did a lot of bad things. So, like, it makes sense that we would want to go in and get rid of him. And that was the very day that Trump was meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, yeah. Mohammed bin Salman, who has done a lot of bad things. And I pointed out to my student that there is no world leader who has not done bad things. But why do we hear so much about the bad things that Maduro is doing right now? It's because the United States is trying to whip up popular sentiment for the overthrow of Maduro. Certainly, the United States has a military-industrial complex that serves to profit off of war and off of fear of war. And this has been absolutely the case, at least since World War II, where there are very specific economic interests in promoting military production. And those economic interests span not only corporate profits, but the large proportion of the US population that works in the military industry. And it's the one publicly supported industry in the country, very successful example of how public investment can create jobs if they're willing to do it. But it's justified with, well, we have to tax people for this because the population is in danger. So the creation of a climate of fear in the United States is another piece of this larger complex of supporting the largest military industry of the world and being the biggest arms trader in the world. So that's one set of interests. Obviously, Venezuela has huge oil supplies, and there are many different private interests in the United States and also public interests that are very wary of independent oil production because it can be a threat to the U.S. industry and it can be a threat to the profits of U.S. oil corporations that want to be there. Now, obviously, Maduro is quite open to U.S. oil companies operating in Venezuela, but at least right now. But the question is not just, is there an opening for U.S. investment, but what are the conditions of U.S. investment? I think that there is within the Trump coalition, the MAGA coalition, a real division between what we call the Latin America hawks, people like Marco Rubio, who are just have this really deep ideological anti-leftism. And, you know, he's a Cuban American and comes from the far right wing of the Cuban anti-Cuban revolution sectors, where it's more ideological than it is economic, this visceral hatred of the left in Latin America. And then within the Trump coalition, we also have the sort of America firsters who are very leery of getting involved in what is likely to be a protracted war and occupation in Venezuela that's going to be extremely costly in terms of U.S. lives and U.S. resources. So I think Trump is managing these two sides of the MAGA coalition. And then there is Trump himself, the ever unpredictable Trump, who, as we know, likes to posture, likes to take extremist positions and then step back from them. You know, we saw him threatening to invade Canada and then then stepping back. Who likes to throw around his weight and promote his image internationally and nationally. And to me, that is sort of a wild card here as to is Trump just posturing, and how do we even separate what's posturing on Trump's part and how far he's willing to go? That is, you know, we saw him negotiating with Iran at the same time that he's bombing Iran. So the unpredictability. But one thing that I think is more predictable about Trump is the U.S. population in general cares a lot more about domestic policy than foreign policy. The U.S. population in general cares about foreign policy only when it is presented in terms of national security, war, or when the United States is involved in a war. And raising the specter of war, I feel, in part works in Trump's interest right now because of the domestic policy failures that are going on. So, you know, in terms of the shutdown, in terms of the loss of support for his aggressive immigration policies, in terms of affordability and inflation, the impact of the tariffs beginning to be felt, in terms of people's dissatisfaction with the Republican stances on the Affordable Care Act and on health care more generally. I think that part of what Trump is after is simply a distraction. You know, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Okay, so sectors at state with a stake in U.S. foreign policy, that's what I would say about that. Finally, just quickly, I wanted to talk about immigration and especially Venezuelan migration, because clearly Venezuelan migration to the United States was greatly increased, that is, the displacement of Venezuelans from their country, because most mass migrations are a result not of just people individually making decisions that, oh, I want to go live somewhere else, but are a result of what I would call displacements that have structural causes. U.S. administrations would like to blame those structural causes on the actions of the Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro governments in Venezuela for the past several decades. But the US policies, especially sanctions on Venezuela and the draconian nature of the sanctions on Venezuela, and covert activities and attempts to overthrow the Venezuelan government clearly have played a huge role as well, and also attempts to impose its sanctions.